Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. Former President Jimmy Carter turned 100 this week. Still controversial as a president, he is generally regarded as the most active and productive former president in recent history, also one of the most religious. Here with me today to discuss his presidency, his post-presidency, and his faith is one of his biographers. Randall Balmer is a professor of religion at Dartmouth College, and he's the author of Redeemer, The Life of Jimmy Carter. Professor Balmer, welcome back to the program. It's good to see you again.
Thank you. Good to be here, Grant.
Well, let me just start with a real basic question. When you were working on this book, did you get to have any interactions at all with the former president?
Oh, I did. I had several interactions with him. I have to say, not long, intensive interview conversations, because so much of his life is already documented, mainly by himself. That is to say, he's written a lot about himself, but also the other sources were available to me. So the advice I got from his staff when I took on the project is that he preferred to talk with people writing books about him toward the end of their project. In other words, he did not want to be involved in kind of fishing expeditions from people saying, I think I'm going to write about it. Yeah, he wanted to make sure that people were serious about it. So I did have several conversations with him, yes.
And any impressions struck you from those brief
interactions? He's a very private man. He's hard to get to know. He was a very good campaigner, as I'm sure that you remember, in 1976. But he's very reserved. I got the impression after our conversations that the only person he really, truly trusted was Rosalynn. He's just a bit standoffish. And actually, I've come to see that there are kind of two poles of political personality. There's Jimmy Carter on the one hand, who I think is basically an introvert, frankly, and people would find that surprising because politicians are not usually known for being introverts. And the other pole, of course, is Bill Clinton, who's just affable and garrulous, probably to a fault. But Jimmy Carter is a man of some reserve, actually. And I came to admire that about him, actually.
Well, similar things have been said about Barack Obama, as I think about it. So I know that you could take the entire time talking about this, but briefly, if you could, how would you sum up Carter's legacy as a president?
Well, I think what's fascinating, and I'm really pleased to see this happening in his lifetime. That is why, while he's still alive, historians are beginning to revisit his presidency, and they're coming away with a much more positive view than the view that was regnant immediately after he left office. That is to say, that there is a sense that he really was not a failure as a president. And I'll kind of go through a few things that I think are pretty important that people are beginning to realize. The big problem that beset him are probably two things that really derailed his reelection in 1980. First of all, the Iran hostage crisis.
Right.
And now it's come to light that the representatives of the Reagan-Bush campaign did indeed conspire with the government of Iran not to release the hostages before the election in November of 1980. So despite Carter's Herculean efforts to free the hostages, had those hostages been freed, I think it's very likely that Jimmy Carter would have been reelected. The second thing is that as you probably remember, in the 1970s, there was great economic distress in this country. Interest rates were hovering around 20%. And that was due, in turn, to the Arab oil embargoes of the 1970s. Well, Carter had a choice as president. He could have appointed as head of the Federal Reserve somebody who would be more politically pliant to him and to his interests. So at least so that he could get reelected in 1980. But he chose not to do that. He elected an inflation hawk, that is, he nominated an inflation hawk, Paul Volcker, as head of the Federal Reserve, who immediately bumped up interest rates sky high in order to to throttle inflation. Well, the long-term benefit of that was the recovery that eventually took place in the early 1980s, but it was too late for Carter to enjoy the political benefits of being reelected in 1980. So those are just a couple of things that, again, historians are beginning to reconsider about his presidency. You have to look at his record on human rights, the Panama Canal Treaty, that now in retrospect looks very much good and better than it did at the time. And Ronald Reagan used that, of course, against Carter in the 1980 election. But I think historians now recognize he probably did the right thing. That is, Carter did the right thing in trying to move away from colonialism in American politics. So these are just a few of the things. That said, there's no question that Carter faced strong headwinds going into the 1980 election. I sometimes refer to 1979 as his terrible, awful, horrible, very bad year. Everything that could go wrong went wrong. Three Mile Island, the taking of the hostages, even disco demolition night at Kaminsky Park in Chicago, July 12, 1979. Everything was going wrong for Jimmy Carter in 1979.
So I wanted to pick up on that last point, and you talk about this in the book, but in 1976, Carter rode this evangelical tide into the White House, and I just share something super quick, personal. My mother, lifelong Republican, voted for Carter in 76, and that was the main reason that she she considered herself an evangelical Christian. But then that tide quickly turned against him, and it turned against the Democratic Party. By 1980, these folks are kind of shifting to Ronald Reagan, and then, you know, they've been a stalwart of the Republicans since then. So what happened?
Well, Grant, I've spent far too many years researching that question, I have to say. And the standard narrative is that the religious right began to gather as a political force in the 1970s in response to the Roe v. Wade decision of 1973. That's the standard narrative. And it's been repeated by everybody from Jerry Falwell to Pat Robertson to many historians and many current white evangelical leaders. And I can say without fear of contradiction that that is absolutely false. Abortion had nothing to do with the rise of the religious right, which of course turned against Jimmy Carter in 1980. I call this the abortion myth. And I know you want to move on to other topics here, so I'm not going to belabor this, but I'll give you a couple of bits of evidence for this. 1971, the Southern Baptist Convention, which is not exactly known as a redoubt of liberalism, passed a resolution calling for the legalization of abortion, a resolution they reaffirmed in 1974, a year after Roe v. Wade, and again in 1979. Jerry Falwell, by his own admission, did not preach his first anti-abortion sermon until February 26, 1978, more than 5 years after the Roe v. Wade decision. So I call this the abortion myth because it had abortion for evangelicals was a Catholic issue in the 1970s. And so it raises the question, what indeed got them mobilized as a political movement? It turns out it was a defense of racial segregation at evangelical institutions, segregation academies, but also, of course, Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina. And this came to a head in the 1970s following a court ruling in a case called Green v. Connolly that was handed down by the District Court for the District of Columbia on June 30th, 1971. And in that ruling, the court said that any organization that engages in racial discrimination or racial segregation is not by definition a charitable institution. And for that reason, it has no claims on tax exempt status. Mm. And as the Internal Revenue Service throughout the 1970s began enforcing that ruling, that got the attention of Bob Jones University. It also got the attention of Jerry Falwell, who had his own segregation academy in Lynchburg, Virginia. And that, it turns out, was the catalyst for the religious right. It had nothing whatsoever to do with abortion. Hmm. So Jimmy Carter got caught in that crossfire. And I asked Mr. Carter about this, and I said, "Were you aware that the IRS was aggressively trying to enforce this?" He said, "No, I had no idea," because he believed, I think rightly, that the Internal Revenue Service should operate independently of the presidency. We all remember Nixon going after his political enemies with the IRS, and Carter was very careful not to do that. So he was utterly unaware of this. Nevertheless, the religious right blamed Carter for trying to enforce the provisions of the Green v. Connolly ruling.
Interesting alternative take. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Randall Balmer, a Dartmouth College religion professor and the author of Redeemer, The Life of Jimmy Carter. So would you say it's fair that Carter is the most overtly religious president we've had, at least in the modern presidential era?
I think in any of any president, and I don't, I suppose, I suppose somebody might make a case for Woodrow Wilson, you know, being a loyal Presbyterian and so forth. But no, I think in all of American history, Jimmy Carter stands out as the most religious, you know, pious president that we've had in all of our history. And I'll defend that against anyone. Some people might want to talk about George W. Bush, but I think that there are probably reasons that Carter eclipses even him.
Yeah, I'm gonna go way out on a limb and say that Carter's probably spent more time reading the Bible than George W. Bush has.
I think so.
But
he's probably spent more time reading the Bible in Spanish than the American president has done in any language.
So on that point, then, one of the reviewers of your book wrote that your book reminds us, and I'm quoting the reviewer here, that there was and could be again a Christian left in American politics. To me, that prospect seems to be even more distant now, not just because what we've been talking about, but a lot of Christians have become more associated with the right for a whole different array of reasons, but also because of what's happening on the left. I mean, it seems to me that the left has become increasingly non-religious for the most part, and even I think anti-religious in some instances. So what are your thoughts about the future of that?
No, I think you're right. I think there is a good bit of antagonism toward religion on the part of folks who line up on the left. And part of that has to be understood as a reaction to what's going on the right with religious right. There's no question about that. Actually, David Hollinger, emeritus professor at University of California, Berkeley, has done a lot of very interesting work on this. And one of the things he's found is that, and I hope I'm characterizing his argument correctly, is that what happened with mainline Protestantism is that the younger generation growing up within mainline Protestantism very much shared the views of progressive religion or progressive evangelicalism even, but they found eventually that it was easier to pursue their ends, their goals, by working through more secular social reform entities than by working through the church. And I think there's a good bit of truth to that. So, but I agree with the premise of your question entirely. That is to say that the left and even the Democratic Party has been at least perceived as hostile to faith and hostile to religion. And I think that's unfortunate. I would love to have the so-called religious left reclaim its own heritage and say, look, you know, this is our history of working for social reform. And by the way, that includes evangelicals, because evangelicalism, particularly in the 19th century, was a powerful engine for social reform. And if we would plot their sympathies and their efforts on a contemporary political spectrum, there is no question that it would lean toward the left, even far to the left. And I would love to see evangelicals reclaim that heritage.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Randall Balmer. He's a professor of religion at Dartmouth College and the author of Redeemer, The Life of Jimmy Carter. The former president turned 100 this past week. So I was talking with a prominent political psychologist the other day, and she's developed a system of discerning the leadership styles of national leaders all around the world based on different kinds of data that is collectible. And I asked her about, you know, what do you think Carter's leadership style was? And she said, I think he's pretty clearly a consultative leader, that was his style, bring people in and get different points of view. What's your sense of that, of his presidential style?
I think that's right. He certainly did consult with others. And one of the people he consulted with regularly, perhaps more than any other, was Rosalynn, his wife.
Mm.
And there was a lot of criticism during his presidency that she was sitting in on cabinet meetings and that sort of thing. But yes, he consulted with a lot of people, but he was not afraid to make up his own mind. And he very often would contradict some of his advisors because he felt that another course was the way to go. And what I heard actually time and time again from his people is that the quickest way to lose an argument, if you were making a case before the president, was to argue that it was politically good for him to do something or another, politically expedient. He said that more than one advisor said that was the quickest way to lose your argument is to make it. But you asked earlier about his personality and my takeaway. I guess my main takeaway, and I should have mentioned this earlier, is that he's a stubborn man. he's a very stubborn man. And I'll give you a quick anecdote about that. As I think I told you, I'm under contract with CNN to provide commentary when Mr. Carter dies. And when he went into hospice a couple of years ago, you know, I kept my phone on the nightstand, you know, waiting any moment. And then finally, after a while, I figured out that he's a stubborn man. First of all, he's going to make it to 100, which he did, of course. And my next prediction is that he's going to make it at least until the election this fall in November, because apparently he's quite excited about the candidacy of Kamala Harris.
I got a question at the end about that I want to put to you. But yeah, I mean, the average lifespan, I believe, of someone in hospice is 17 days, and he's working on a year and a half now. So on that issue, though, of political expediency, I was listening to an older interview with Jimmy Carter the other day, and he was asked what his biggest political mistake as president was. Mm. And this is what he said. He said, it was not bombing Iran for the taking of the hostages. What do you make of that?
Yeah, he was. My guess is that he also said in that interview that ultimately it was the right thing to do. He does believe it probably cost him the election in 1980. And he's also lamented the fact, you probably remember, that there was an abortive attempt to seize the hostages. And it ran into technical troubles there in the desert. And he's often said, if he had had one more plane on that rescue mission, he might have been reelected as president in 1980. But he's also said that, and my guess is that this is probably a segue into your next question here, but he's also said, and he told me this quite explicitly, he said, if I had been reelected in 1980, it's very likely that I would not have done a lot of the things that I've done since leaving the White House. Yeah. So, and some people have talked about his post-presidency as his second term, and I understand that sort of designation. But he was very clear that it was likely that he would not have done a lot of the things that he actually has done since leaving the White House.
If you just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is Dartmouth College professor Randall Balmer. You're right. You anticipated exactly where I was going to go, is to look at his post-presidency. And he's been universally seen as a particularly effective ex-president. He's had more years than any other president, 44 of them, to work on that legacy, but he hasn't wasted any time at all in any of those four. So just, you know, briefly, I know you could talk about this for a very long time. Just give us some quick reminders of some of the things he's done after leaving office.
Well, probably the most recognizable effort than people would understand immediately has been his work with Habitat for Humanity. And mm-hmm. So Habitat for Humanity was just kind of getting started when he left office. And his participation in building houses was a huge boost to them in terms of publicity, and of course raising money, because here you had a former president who was out there swinging hammers and working quite energetically in building these houses. So that would probably be the most recognizable. But after, and let me put this in context, his defeat in 1980 was devastating to him, and actually particularly to Roseland. And one of the things that he mentioned in one of our conversations is that I think I asked the question, you know, how is it, how did, I was trying to get it into his psyche a little bit and his personality. How is it that you were able to rebound so quickly after the 1980 election? And he said the reason he did so was that he had to keep reassuring Roseland that they did have, you know, they had a lifetime ahead of them. They could do meaningful things for the rest of their lives, where she was really angry. She was quite upset with a number of people, not only Ronald Reagan, but Ted Kennedy, who, of course, had challenged Carter for the Democratic nomination in 1980, as well as other people in the media and so forth. And what Mr. Carter told me is that I had to keep reassuring Rosalind so frequently that I began finally to believe what I was saying. And the idea for the Carter Center came to him in the middle of the night. And the idea, as he articulated it, was to set up a kind of Camp David, which, of course, had been quite successful in bringing about the Camp David Accords between Israel and Egypt in 1979. And so the Carter Center was meant to be, and has been, of course, an activist center. Most presidential libraries are celebratory institutions, that is to celebrate the presidency and the accomplishment and the life of the various presidents. And the Carter Library has that. The museum has, you know, various exhibits that do that. But he was more interested in establishing an activist center, the Carter Center, to work on various issues around the world that were important to him.
Yeah, and it's certainly, from my perspective, been much more visible than the other presidential libraries and centers. You know, you were talking about him being stubborn, and you know he's determined to reach 100. A little more personal question for you, perhaps, but you know, given religion and the role it's played in your life and your understanding of it, do you think maybe his faith is one of the reasons why he's made it to 100?
Well, I think so. First of all, he's lived a clean life. all of his siblings and his parents died at fairly early ages. Miss Lily and his mother lived to be fairly elderly, but that was in part because they were all smokers and he was not. You know, his sister, Ruth Carter Stapleton, his brother Billy, of course, who was quite notorious during Carter's presidency, and his father died at an early age. 53, if I remember correctly. Wow. And Carter has lived a very clean life in comparison even to his family. So that, I think that's part of it. But I think also he has a sense of what's important, and it's beyond himself. It's beyond his political successes, which, let's remember, his rise to the presidency in 1970 was meteoric. And so I think that probably is... given him a sense of larger purpose.
Yeah, purpose. I think you've hit on the key. Well, we've got about 3 minutes left. I want to squeeze this last question in, and you might not like it, but I'm a political scientist and I can't help myself. I'm going to circle back around to what you said about him being excited about seeing Kamala Harris' campaign and wanting to stay alive to see that through. I'm going to put a different take on this. I apologize. But he has been defying all the odds and hanging on this long. And I wonder, you know, there's all this talk about October surprises. I wonder if he were to pass between now and Election Day, that could be a so-called October surprise that would help the Democrats quite a bit, particularly because this election is anticipated to be so close, that it would create, you know, you'd have the state funeral. Obviously, he'd be lying in state at the Capitol, most likely. That there would be this outpouring of, I think, you know, this kind of rethinking of that era, that would, I think, serve to sort of underline the Democratic message that they're trying to push about unity. And to maybe I'm taking this too far, but that might be his final political redemption as president in terms of his legacy from 1980. I mean, what about the, you like alternative scenarios? You had a chapter on alternative scenarios right. at the end of this book. So right. so here's an alternative scenario for yours that he's living to see this election. What if he doesn't live to see this election? Maybe in some ways that's the better outcome for the party, and
would be his final gift to, yeah. to the Democrats. Yeah, it could play out that way. I think you know if I were to take an opposite view, I would say that some of the criticisms that characterized his presidency would resurface as well. I think it's fair to say that Donald Trump is not exactly a fan of Jimmy Carter. That would probably give him an opportunity to vent a little bit about Mr. Carter, which I think is unwarranted, but nevertheless, I'm sure he would do that. And it's possible. It's possible that that would play out that way. I guess the parallel that comes to mind would be the 2004 political campaign, and that is when Kerry was running against Bush, who was running for re-election, and Ronald Reagan died. I don't remember the date, but sometime in the fall of that, just prior to the election in 2004, and Bush won the re-election. I'm not sure that Reagan's death necessarily helped his efforts. It's hard to say. It could be that it happened that way. Who knows? That's a fascinating alternate scenario, and certainly when we're talking about somebody who's 100 years old, that could happen at any time. That's for sure.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. That was Randall Balmer, and again, his book on Jimmy Carter is titled "Redeemer: The Life of Jimmy Carter," and it's a really nice encapsulation of his life that talks both about his faith and, of course, about his political life. Professor Balmer, thanks again for taking the time to speak with me. I really enjoyed it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, conversations in the public interest, is hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio. Assistant producer is Jacqueline Witwicky, and the program is edited by Mark Lefonier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program and hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.